Has come. February the 8th, 8:30 in the morning, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5066. Anne-Marie Housley assisting us as staff, Dallas Lund. And we are convening a subcommittee of the subcommittee this morning to begin taking testimony from the Department of Revenue. Sorry. Good morning, Director Harshenko, and I am asked to have folks that are testifying say their name for the record, spell it if it's an unusual spelling, state your position if you would be so kind, and we are to remind everyone, including the chair, that this is an acronym-free environment until we've sufficiently established the full name that we can switch to acronyms, but try to maintain an acronym-free environment.
Acronym-free environment. A-F-E.
There you go.
Good.
And once again,
A-F-E's
thank Anne-Marie for cookies. You're spoiling us absolutely rotten. So with that, good morning, Director Harshenko, and let's start.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, H-A-R-C-H-E-N-K-O, Director of your Department of Revenue. With me today is Susan Browning, the deputy, and Kelly Friels is sitting in on behalf of our regular analyst for Budget Management Division, who is Linda Ames. Susan and I will be switching back and forth to cover the information that we have in your presentation binder. And we will begin with phase one. I understand we have today and tomorrow primarily to do our overview and then clean up Q&A and maybe a little bit of conversation about the 2003 to 2005 leftovers on Thursday. Okay, beginning on page 1-2 of the binder, the mission of the department is to make tax systems work. We understand that our job is to assure that the funding stream is available to fund the services that state and local government provide for the citizens, and so we take that business seriously. Our values are set forth on page 1-3, and I think it's important for you to understand, and for the senators who were able to come over yesterday for our tour and saw folks handling a lot of tax returns with a lot of confidential information and a lot of money, that these values are really, really important to the way we do our work. We instill them in our staff. Very high ethical standards, operational excellence, being very responsible with our budget and with the funds that we handle on behalf of citizens. And quality relationships, which is something that's maybe a little bit broader than customer service, but definitely embraces that. It's how we work together, how we work with you, how we work with our partners in state government and local government, and how we work with citizens. We've given you a brief overview of the programs on page 1-4 that the department has been given by the legislature over the years. As you can see, property tax was in the beginning, but we, in the late 20s and 1930s, picked up income taxes. We handle taxes related to forest products. We do valuation of industrial property and utility property. We manage the tobacco tax programs. We collect for other state agencies. Something over 270 different state agencies use our service, our collection services. We also collect under contract for the two transit districts, one in Lane County and one in the Portland metropolitan area. And we administer a variety of smaller volume taxes, severance taxes, the emergency communications tax that funds the 911 system. We actually gave one away. We got the dry cleaners fee and distributors tax, and that's been transferred to environmental quality. And we, our latest one was the lodging tax, which was enacted in 2003. The organization of the department is set forth on 1-5. We have four operating divisions. The most important thing I think for you to know about between the business division and the personal tax and compliance division is we used to be divided by function. Audit was one group, collection was one group, and we had taxpayers sort of bouncing back and forth between the two, and so we reorganized in the mid-90s and focused on who's the taxpayer. So personal tax and compliance focuses on individuals, business division focuses on businesses. Property tax is a group that focuses on that system and works with our external partners in the counties.
Director, if you don't mind me interrupting for just a second, I note with great interest in 1996 when you did get rid of the dry cleaner's fee. When that happened, did you calculate the amount of administrative costs that it was it cost your department to process this when it got transferred to DEQ? Was there a cost associated with the loss of the function that you then transferred to DEQ and it was fee for service at that point? Or did you just cease doing it?
Madam Chair, we'll get very clear information on that, but our belief is that when we administer the dry cleaner's fee, our cost of administration came out of the gross receipts, and that's happening at DEQ. What I don't know is, off the top of my head, is what our cost was and what their cost is.
Let me make my point better rather than having you go search for information that may not be relevant. The point I'm trying to make here is that in 1996, for some reason, you all came to the conclusion in conjunction with your sister agency that it didn't make sense for you to collect this fee any longer. And what I'm relating it to is the elderly rental assistance that we discussed in my office and the fact that that is a program that is declining at this point and that there might be some rational reason to move that program someplace else with the concomitant costs associated with the administration of that program. And I just note your willingness to have looked at perhaps having a tax collected someplace else, and if it's applicable to any of the work that you're doing now and is more coherent to put it someplace else, that there has been precedent established to do so. And I'm just trying to get a sense for how much it costs to administer the elderly rental program and if it made sense to put that in housing or someplace else, given how small the program is and that it is declining.
Madam Chair, we do have information about our administrative costs for the elderly rental assistance and nonprofit homes for the elderly program, and it's in the presentation materials.
Good. We'll get to it then in the testimony. I'm sorry. Continue, please.
Thank you. Our information processing division is the group you visited. The processing center is part of that organization, as is our information technology services section, our human resources section, and our finance folks who handle the accounting and budgeting and project management for the department. We have field offices around the state, and a relatively new practice on our part is attaching what we call satellite offices to some of our field offices, where we have two staff people with space inside an existing state facility, example Pendleton, North Bend, and Newport, being able to provide a presence in community economically without the cost of a full field office where the work doesn't demand that, and we're getting very good reception in those communities to having people available as a resource to taxpayers and practitioners in those three cities. Turning to page 1-6, you're going to see now a series of pages that try to lay out for you in visual form the functions we perform with respect to each of our big programs. We tend to lump our income tax programs together. Personal income tax is individuals. The corporate taxes, we have the corporation excise tax, which is measured by net income. It is imposed for the privilege of doing business in the state in corporate form. And then we have a corporate income tax, which is also measured by net income. It is applied to corporations that aren't doing business in the state but have income from sources within the state, say rental income or some other source of income. And for all of those taxes, we perform the functions that we have listed there on the page, education and assistance, processing, banking, auditing of returns, collection of overdue payments, and filing enforcement, which is finding individuals or corporations that should be filing and are not. The projected revenue stream for this next biennium from both of those taxes is just over $10 billion, and that all goes into the general fund. In the lower left, we have some data about our administrative costs, the numbers of folks that are working in these programs. And we've tried to, it's a little hard sometimes to tie the information that we've got to all the data. So you'll see the $10.4 billion comes from the forecast, and then the FTE and the admin cost is from the governor's recommended budget. And for those of you who've been around for a while, you've seen the services picture, what services are paid for with the Oregon income tax dollar. We use this as part of our education with on the website with high school students and anybody else who's curious about where their income taxes go. On page 1-8, we've got the same thing for the property tax program. You can see that that program generates a substantial amount of revenue for local government, and our part in that program is valuation of the very complex properties that are sometimes counties, especially those with very small populations and small resources, just don't have the expertise or the resources to do. And so we value the railroads, airlines, telecommunications companies, energy providers, and then allocate that value back to the counties. We also are responsible for valuing all industrial property, which would be manufacturing plants, fish food processing plants, chemical plants, electronics companies, that where their value is $1 million or more, and certifying those values back to the counties as well.
And just for the benefit of the committee and out of respect for a couple of county folks that are in the audience, there is a great deal of interest around this issue area, and counties had asked to be able to testify during this first phase of the budget presentations. It is the decision of the co-chairs that not occur in this first high-level overview. However, out of respect for the partnership that exists between the state and the county, I have gotten the co-chair's permission that in phase two, the counties would come in and make a comprehensive presentation about their shared revenue and the county's portion, particularly with respect to the shared revenue, that they would be first up as invited testimony in phase two of the Ways and Means presentation.
Madam Chair, one of the things I'll be talking about as we get a little more deep into this property tax program is talking about that relationship. We also provide mapping services. We are responsible for assuring that the 36 counties administer the property tax system in as uniform a manner as possible. There's a constitutional requirement for uniform administration of the system. We also determine values of forest lands that are used by the assessors around the state. The administrative information at the bottom is just the revenue department's piece of the cost of the system. And you can see on page 9 where those revenues go. Page 1-10 gives you the same information for the tobacco programs. The cigarette tax is by far the largest, probably by an order of 10 times the size of the other tobacco tax program revenue streams. But we perform pretty much the same functions as we do for our income taxes. Process payments, bank payments, collect on any overdue accounts, audit returns, inspect retail establishments to assure that the taxes have been paid on tobacco products that they have for sale. And the Department of Justice and the state police perform criminal investigations and prosecutions. They are paid through our budget because the costs of administration of these programs come out of the net revenue.
How large a staff do you have doing these inspections?
Madam Chair, in In 2001, the task force was first created, and it started with 17 staff people, including state police, and I guess 18, nine of ours and nine from the state police and Department of Justice. In 2003, there was a significant group added. I think it's like 27 positions. We've called Task Force 2. Task Force 1 is the base group that was created in 2001. And so we had probably 15 or so compliance specialists out in the field visiting retailers, making sure that the products that they had for sale had been, that the tax had been paid on those products. The governor's recommended budget eliminates Task Force 2, so we'll go back to a different strategy of trying to monitor to see whether there's any erosion in that compliance, but at least based on the inspections that we've done during this current biennium, we have a very high level of compliance now at the retail level within the state.
Has there ever been any discussion about the cross-training of any other inspectors that are in and out of small business in order to not have siloed shops of inspection, but rather cross-training so that the OLCC folks might be able to do work on your behalf, or the food inspector safety for the Department of Ag might be able to do any of that?
Madam Chair, there have been discussions that have been fostered by the streamlining office within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, looking for ways to ease the inspection burden on small business particularly. And we've had some conversations with a wide variety of agencies, just beginning conversations about could that be done, and if so, how. But there hasn't been any activity to actually do that or pilot that on the ground.
Would some legislative incentive help drive forward those conversations?
Madam Chair, I think that there's a high degree of interest on the governor's part to streamline the regulatory environment for business in the state, and I think it's a matter of resource priorities for everyone, and really some significant differences in mission of some of the agencies. But we have talked more than once about trying to cross-train with the Liquor Commission. There were some conversation in 2001 with the legislature about some of the inspections that the state police do seasonally to assure compliance with a federal law that prohibits sales to minors of tobacco products. But we just haven't gotten to the point of trying to pilot to coordinate. I think our task force is the first place where we have multiple agencies trying to deal with a set of issues.
I might suggest to our colleagues here that given the budgets that are being seen in Representative Smith's committee, of which four of us are members, that there might be an opportunity to find both some efficiencies and some cost savings, as well as to minimize the folks that are prancing through small retail establishments doing inspections. So this might be an area that we would want to probe in some greater detail.
That's a wonderful idea, Madam Chair.
Sorry.
That's important to raise, because it is an issue that we've heard loud and clear from small business that, you know, the state's coming, and then the state's coming, and then the state's coming, and we don't appear to be talking to each other. So it's something that we really need to work on more. One thing we will talk about maybe a little bit later, maybe in phase two, is we've got a piece of legislation that is working its way through the system related to the determination of who is an independent contractor for purposes of tax compliance, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, and the agencies have been designing a project to cross-train and work with each other so that we don't have that visit, 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 visit. So there's a place where we are talking about doing that with a little more concrete plan.
Thank you.
Page 1-11 has the services that are paid for from the cigarette and other tobacco tax revenues. And then the next four pages show you the other programs that simply because of the dollar volume involved are minor compared to the income tax and the property tax. We administer the inheritance tax program, the amusement device tax, which is now imposed only on lottery terminals, petroleum load fee, which is a fee that's designed to deal with hazardous materials, emergency response, the lodging tax, which was just enacted last legislative session, hazardous substance fee, similar to that petroleum load in terms of purpose and use. The tax is related to forest land. The small owner severance tax is a new program. There's been a significant change in the way that forest products are taxed in Oregon over the last three sessions, and we now have a special program available to small owners who may have cash flow problems because they don't harvest every year. So that's a relatively new program. We do collect the forest products harvest tax, which again funds some very specific purposes. I earlier mentioned the emergency communications, which funds the 911 system across the state.
As we turn the page, Representative Smith has a question.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Good seeing you today. I've got a couple questions, actually. First, can you send me additional information on the inheritance tax and the small owner severance tax? And perhaps it's further in here, but I'd like additional information. And then a quick question, if I may. We tax lottery terminals. Can you explain how that works?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the amusement device tax is an older tax in Oregon, and it used to apply to, pool tables, little kids' rides, amusement games, you know, the flipper ball kinds of games, just a wide variety, miscellaneous variety of amusement rides and amusement devices. When the lottery went into the terminals, the legislature changed the focus of that tax and eliminated all the other devices and just imposed the charge on lottery terminals. And it's actually now the money actually comes to us through the lottery. They collect it because they know, of course, how many terminals they have. But that's been several sessions back.
Just a quick follow-up.
So does the
entrepreneur who has a lottery machine in their establishment go through a paperwork process to pay this tax?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think we're going to have to get a little more information for
Please
you about that.
Perfect.
And perhaps what we could do is just get you a brief narrative provided to all the committee members, a narrative about these three, the inheritance, the amusement device, and the small owner. Our because of the time that we have with you, we're focusing on the mammoth programs, and these for us are small, but we're glad to get you some.
And please, I just want 101,
yeah.
You know, 20,000-foot level.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. Then on 1-14 and 1-15, we have other programs that aren't tax administration necessarily, but because of the expertise that we have in collecting funds, we are the a designated state collection agency for other state agencies and for the court system. We have two types of services that agencies can take advantage of. One is income tax refund offset. Child support uses that extensively. Other agencies use that as well. And then a full range of collection services like we use for our income tax programs with all the tools of attachment and garnishment as well as the refund offset. Agencies can choose whether they want to use one or both services. We recover our cost of administration from the amount of money that we collect. And then we do a truing up at the end. Is it every year, Susan? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do a truing up at the end of each year. And if the rate that we've charged generated more than our cost, then we rebate it back to the agencies pro rata so that we only recover our actual cost of collection. We also administer, as I said, TriMet and Lane Transit District taxes, both their self-employment tax and their payroll-based tax, under contract, and we recover our costs again from the revenue stream, and we remit the net revenues out to those two local entities. Finally, we administer two assistance programs. The elderly rental assistance program actually is two. There is a line item in our, there has been a line item in our budget each biennium. It was $9 million last biennium, and I think it's $9 million again this biennium in the governor's rec, to provide payments to very low-income elderly renters. I think they have to have an income level below $10,000 gross income. They have to be renting. They file a claim form or a request for the payment at the same time as income tax returns are due. And we issue those payments, which are a percentage of their rental expense. In this last biennium, we were just a little over $5 million, I think, in those payments. The other program that's funded from that same appropriation is a funded property tax exemption. The legislature funds an exemption for nonprofit homes for the elderly. They, too, have to apply to have their property taxes paid by the state. They have to demonstrate that the savings that they experience from not having to pay their property tax flows through to their residents. And that was about $2.5 million, I think, this biennium, and 45 to 48 entities took advantage of that program. Then we also administer two property tax deferral programs, one for seniors. It's been around for quite some time and was recently expanded to include the disabled. People who are eligible have to be below a certain income level and own their own home. And the state pays their property taxes, takes a lien on the property, charges, I think it's 6% simple interest, and then the lien is required to be paid at the time the property is either sold or the qualifying individual dies. People can choose to pay off all or a part of the lien at any time. So that those are the two assistance programs. Now we're going to move into our performance measures, and Susan is going to talk to you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ivakian.
Does the Department of Revenue ever engage in selling interest it has in liens like that in order to get money prior to exercising a lien?
Madam Chair, Representative Ivakian, we don't have authority to sell liens. And the liens for that senior deferral program are second to purchase money mortgages. Hmm. The program has been self-sustaining for over 20 years, and we've actually, when we have excess reserves, we return those to the general fund, which provided the seed money when the program was created.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Susan Browning. I'm Deputy Director, Department of Revenue. And on page 1-16, we have the beginning of our information about our performance measures. And these are our formal measures. We actually, as Elizabeth and I go through the book, you'll see we have a lot more performance outcomes, and we'll point those out, too. And you saw some of those during your tour of the processing center, I think, including such things as production standards for data entry and some of those type things. But these are our formal measures that we have for the department. And we can go through this in as much detail as you like or as little. So we'll start off on page 1-16. This executive summary capsulizes the information that's on your annual performance report on pages 1-17 through 1-19. But some of the questions that you asked were, how are we using the performance measures for management of the agency? We really use them as we work to develop areas for improvement. We put together a business plan that we're going to be talking about later, and that the measures help build our business plan and give us some ideas of things we want to concentrate on and work toward. The areas of, I think that we're becoming increasingly aware of the measures, and we have some more work. There's some areas we'll be pointing out as you look at them individually that we've been tweaking them and have some requests to modify them as well. We found we need some little bit of changes on some of them. The linkage to the Oregon benchmarks. Department of Revenue really has links only to one major benchmark, percentage of Oregonians who understand the Oregon tax system and where the tax money is spent. Elizabeth showed you the little pie charts. That's a challenging benchmark, let me tell you.
I think that's why the whole committee is.
We're all relying on the committee.
Yeah.
You might start with the legislature.
It is very challenging. I think as we moved off of the property tax, towards more of a major role for the income tax, it's surprising to a lot of people what taxes pay for what services and how much of the income tax actually supports the schools right now. So that's why we developed those charts. We have big laminated versions of them we take out to community groups and use them in the schools and try to help improve that. That's one of the key things we believe, and we'll be talking about that a little bit more with income tax programs. One of our philosophies is that if Oregonians understand better where their tax money goes and how it's used, and it's for very good things that I think most Oregonians would support, they would be some more supportive of actually filing and paying their taxes accurately and timely. So that's our philosophy guiding some of that as well.
What Madam Chair?
Representative Buckin.
What schools do you say taking them to schools? What level of do you have a program within the department where you do that kind of outreach?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, every year we do what we call a community outreach plan with our income tax programs and try to, as much as possible, using the satellite offices and field offices especially, actually go out into the community and make presentations to groups to help improve their knowledge of the tax system. And part of that includes the schools. And we really try to drive it on a local basis so that the staff in the local area identify areas where they think it would be most helpful to go out. We also have a high school student website that we have out there that actually can be used by individuals and their parents, students and their parents, or it can be used by the schools as well. And it actually gives a lot of background about how the tax system works. It actually works the students through completing their own tax return, too. So if they got their first job, our thought is that's when you need to learn how to file and pay your taxes. And take that responsibility on yourself and not just necessarily give it to your parents to do it for you. But to also understand why you're doing it and the importance of it. So we need to build an educated, compliant workforce coming up through their career, too, if we're going to be successful long-term.
Senator Morsette.
Thank you. Now, if we go into the revenue department, where do we find your outreach program, the school part particularly? I need a website.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsette, the outreach program is pretty much through our personal income tax program, the Personal Tax and Compliance Division, and we can get you more information on it and supply you a copy of our plan.
I would like to be able to pass that on to my school districts.
You bet. We'll get you the information on that.
Once again, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask that all the information come through our professional staff and then you disperse it to all the committee, because I'm sure all of our schools would benefit from that.
You bet. And we are available, Madam Chair, Senator Morsette, too. If time allows, we try to balance these different pieces, but if time allows, we're delighted to go out and work with.
Thank you. Before you continue, I'm going to ask for some comments from Dallas, who had the opportunity to visit with the co-chairs a little bit and may give us some guidance about how we're going to approach going through your performance measures.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, yesterday afternoon we met with the co-chairs, or I did, and we reviewed the department's performance measures that are included in the appendix here. There are a number of them, and they had some specific things they thought we should delve into over a number of them. I'll be happy to go through them as they cover them if you'd like, but I just want to put that up.
I think that's the best. We'll allow you to go ahead with your formal presentation, but as Dallas has specific questions related to the actual performance measures in the appendix, I'm going to ask that he interrupt us and help guide us through maybe a more detailed review of those measures per the co-chairs. Okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and the linkage to the Oregon benchmark, we talked a little bit about that. We do get information out to Oregonians. We even try to put information out on the tax refund check stubs to help explain more about that. You asked about successes that we have had with achieving our performance major targets, and we listed about three down there. We have got a significant increase in the number of taxpayer contacts we've had through our agency website and our interactive voice response system. So more and more people are taking advantage of the website to learn information about taxes and how to comply correctly themselves. We've also had an increase in the number of personal income tax returns that have been filed as a result of our filing enforcement. And that's really important to us because it's filing enforcement goes out and identifies individuals or businesses we believe should be filing but who are not. And as we work with those persons, if we can get them to voluntarily file their own return, they've made a commitment to paying that tax or recognizing that they have that responsibility. So that's one of the fairly newer measures we put out there that we want our agents and our auditors as they work through that to get the, hopefully get the taxpayer to the point where they recognize they do have to file, they do need to pay, and they do that voluntarily as far as the filing piece.
I appreciate the voluntary compliance and the kinder, gentler Department of Revenue attitude towards getting taxpayers to understand their own reason for voluntarily complying. In fairness to those taxpayers who do voluntarily file and pay their taxes, talk a little bit about how you encourage those who don't subscribe to your voluntary program.
Well, we do have what we call a balanced approach. That includes education, assistance, and enforcement. And filing enforcement is part of enforcement. We will work to get the taxpayer to voluntarily comply. If they don't, we will set up an assessment. We determine as best we can using all the information we have. We have access to a lot of confidential databases for state and federal data. We try to determine an accurate amount of income that we think that person made, and then determine tax. We try to estimate withholding as well. And we will send that assessment out. If the taxpayer doesn't respond, that becomes final. That's what the taxpayer owes. They can provide us a true return, what they actually had, and we'll look at that. We'll take that into account. But if we don't hear from them, we're going to go out and we're going to collect that amount of money. And we will do that through our standard collection process, which involves, you know, a demand letter, and then we will proceed to a administrative warrant, administrative judgment. And with the administrative judgment, we can then garnish wages, we can garnish bank accounts. If we believe it's appropriate, we will put a lien out on real and personal property, and then we'll start taking action against their assets.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. One of the issues we talked about in my office, and I still am a little bit foggy on it, is when individuals have an obligation owing, but there's yet to be a judgment, I'm struggling with how we protect other people from becoming victims of this individual, primarily in the lending business. And I don't know what the solution is, but I really think there's a significant problem in lack of information available to the lending institutes in terms of amounts owing outstanding to the state of Oregon. If I take credit from a bank and I look to get additional credit, the bank will pull a credit report and see that I have credit. With the state of Oregon, for all points and purposes, the state of Oregon is extending credit in a way by someone not paying their obligation, and yet there's no way for other lenders to be able to see that there's an outstanding debt owed. And many times that would sway a lender's decision-making process. And I don't know what the solution is, but it's a significant problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we did talk with Representative Smith about that, and that comes into play when we're just taking action against the taxpayer on an administrative judgment against, like, wages in bank accounts, so we haven't actually recorded the warrant. Once it becomes recorded and there's a lien against the property, then it is public knowledge, and that would appear on the credit report. But we use our own professional judgment as to whether to take that step or not because there is an expense and we need to find property there that's worth actually taking a lien against. And it's something we can certainly look and think about with you, Representative Smith, because I understand your concern about not having that actually out on the debtor's
dilemma is if you have a small business owner who owes the Department of Revenue, let's say $50,000, and a bank steps up to make a collateral loan, and they think they're in a first security position, they're not. As soon as you file that lien, they've diminished their collateral position by $50,000 plus penalties plus interest. And it really creates a burden for especially small community banks. So anyway, I don't know the solution, but I know we have an issue there.
And Madam Chair, Representative Smith, in the past we had traditionally just recorded pretty much everything, and the expense of the recording fees has gone up quite a bit now. So we found it as a big budgetary issue, and we revised that. But we can sure look at that, too, because I understand your
policy
concerns.
Issue more than a budget. So
yeah.
One other thing I'd like you to speak to is the timeliness of your collection process and how much uncollected money is on the accounts right now. How old is it? What's your collection procedure?
Okay. Would you like to talk about that now, right now, Madam Chair, as part of this?
As long as we're on this
line,
sure.
Okay. See, I got some information about our accounts receivable for you. Our accounts receivable right now, which personal income tax is the numbers I pulled because that's primarily that's the bulk of our accounts receivable. As of these are from the Legislative Fiscal Office, which I believe Dallas actually works on putting these reports together. And the net receivables, let's see, we have available for collection is $552 million. We have out at private collections $92 million, and that leaves $459 million. And of that, we've collected $79 million.
Collected, pardon me, how much?
$79 million. And I wanted to give you some perspective on the amount.
Let me make sure that I understand that the whole committee does.
And I can provide this report to
you. Your universe of receivables is $552 million.
Mm-hmm.
Of that, you have $92 million out to private collection agencies, leaving a balance of $459 million.
Yes.
And then you said you had collected of that $459, $79
million? Yes. And that gives us a percentage, Madam Chair, of 17.2% collection.
But leaving an uncollected, I don't have a calculator, and I'm not sure I can do this fast enough in my head, leaving $380 million. Still owing.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And what's the plan? Go ahead, Representative.
Just really quick, I don't understand how you can have an accounts receivable and have it collected.
Madam Chair, I'll provide you this report,
okay.
Too. But basically, we've taken it from the LFO report that shows the beginning inventory at this period of time, how much we added, what we had available for collection. It's kind of a little balance sheet type thing I'm using here. And then how much of that's available for private collection. And then netting that out.
So it's a cash flow statement.
It's cash flow kind of stuff, more than anything else, yeah. And so that shows you the balance of it. I want to provide some information, if I may, Madam Chair, about the composition of that, though, because when you just look at the sheer dollar, it's a little bit misleading, perhaps, of that amount. We have the ability through House Bill 3509, which came into play several biennia back, to ask for exemptions of accounts from passing on to private collection. And right now for the Department of Revenue, we have a total exemption request out. We've requested exemption of $168 million. That $168 million is the filing enforcement amount. That's the amount that's owed by people who are non-filers. So that amount, when we actually get it collected, may be much less than that. That's the amount we have assessed out against those people is $168 million. Some of the people have still not responded and are not working with us, so we don't know if that represents a good, accurate estimate on our behalf. If it's too high, it's usually too high. We estimate too high normally. So as we resolve those accounts, that amount of money will go down. But filing enforcement accounts are very difficult to collect. We first of all need to find some kind of assets, and that takes us quite a while to do usually because the taxpayer hasn't filed and is sometimes quite reluctant to work with us. So $168 million of that is for filing enforcement. There we have an additional $66 million that's exempted by statute. And of that,
let me stop you and get Senator Morsett's question.
It sounds like you're being very polite. Are there any jail sanctions, incarceration sanctions, when people simply absolutely refuse to pay? They thumb their nose at you and say, go away. I don't have any assets. I'm not going to pay. Forget it.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the steps we take when people tell us to go away and are basically we get much more aggressive. We do seizures. We will, if the person has, as a last resort, if they have an occupational or professional license, we'll ask that that license be suspended. We've done that for dentists. We've done that for attorney. We worked with the bar on some attorneys. We've done that with other groups. We don't have the criminal sanctions as the IRS does. Oftentimes, though, if the person owes us money, there's many times they have the same predicament with the IRS, and some of the taxpayers will end up being pursued for criminal issues or for much more serious consequences with the IRS.
Are you concluding?
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Just one last question. Mm-hmm. Can you send me information on how you deal with individuals who register themselves as LLCs or corporations? And how you handle them if they choose not to file their taxes, the corporation or the LLC chooses not to?
Madam Smith, Madam Chair, Ms. Representative Smith, we certainly will. You bet.
I think this whole area is one that we're going to want to flag for some additional conversation in phase two, including how you track your accounts receivable. And Dallas's professional staff may want to make a comment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Going back to House Bill 3509, which requires agencies to report their outstanding, what are referred to as delinquent and liquidated accounts receivable. Let me give you the context. It's not as simple as 30, 60, 90 days past due, because different federal and state statutes will trigger what is determined to be a delinquent account. But liquidated is a term that seems a little unique to government, because a liquidated account is one where the person that owes the money actually acknowledges that that is the case. Either it can be liquidated because the person agrees that that's the amount known, or it can be liquidated because the courts say that is how much you owe. And it's the combination of the two then that get into our report, because there are laws in place to protect the citizen from government just establishing an amount due and then some sort of penalizing enforcement and taking. So the Department of Revenue has this 1 year to what the trigger is. If they don't collect it within a year, any collection, the law says it has to go to another collection agency. And for their personal income tax on the revenue agent side, there's a meter on each account that shows how many days, and I can't remember, since the last collection or until it has to go out. I just don't remember. It's just that meter is clicking
since the
there.
Last collection.
It's since the last collection. So once that meter goes to 365 days, which would say a year, then it automatically goes to another collection service. But they don't have it, you know, 30 days. It's individual. I'm not sure if the system can track it by 30, 60, 90, but they have to operate within the statutory framework, which says a year before you do something.
Senator Morse.
My interest would be in how you use your aging analysis as a management tool, because in the business world, the least desirable thing to do is to have to go out and collect. It's more fun to go sell, to produce and sell, than it is to collect, and that's a hard thing. But an age analysis becomes a management tool, and quite often you'll find that accounts that are delinquent, if you begin to manage them early in the process, the higher you have a much higher percentage of collection than if you wait until they, you know, just drop off the table, and then by then you're way down the list, and you can manage for a higher degree of collection if you're aggressive in doing it. And what I'd be interested to know is how you use your age analysis as a management tool, not necessarily as a requirement of statute, to maximize collections.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that's a very good point, and that's something we certainly work towards.
Do you have people managing these accounts, a certain section of the Department of Revenue, and do you keep, for all intents and purposes, the kind of tool that Senator Morris is referring to, an actual aging?
We do have information, Madam Chair, that we look at, and we try to manage our accounts receivable very well and very closely. When I was giving you the perspective, of, and goes along with what Dallas is telling you as well, is the Department of Revenue's accounts are a little bit unique, I think, because what actually comes into the liquidated piece is the filing enforcement part, which the taxpayer has not agreed to that amount. But it is final because under statute it becomes final at the point we assess it and the time period falls. So about half of our accounts receivable, really 40%, is this amount that's still in play. We don't know how it's going to be resolved once we actually get the taxpayer to work with us. And it's out there quite a while sometimes. And it's out there purposely quite a while. We have this struggle between should we give up on the taxpayer and write it off because we can't get them to cooperate, or should we hold to the line and work with them and keep after them till they pay. And we've erred on the side of we got to keep after them and get them to pay because they represent a threat to the whole system.
Senator Morissette.
This boggles my mind that we are so kind and gentle to people who are not paying when other people do pay, and it bothers me a lot. Now, do you keep track of federal enforcement, federal criminal charges? Do you ever correlate them to the state people who owe? And go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we try to use kinder and gentler. We'll talk a little bit about our code of conduct. It's not kinder and gentler, though. What we talk about is treating people the way we would want to be treated. We give everybody a fair opportunity to cooperate. And when we don't, we go out pretty actively. We have field agents that meet people in their homes or in their businesses. We take pretty aggressive action. I think some people think we're pretty aggressive sometimes.
May I follow up? Do you consider the feelings of people who do pay their taxes and the programs that we can't fund because people don't pay? I mean, if you're going to consider feelings, think of the people who conscientiously pay their taxes all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm going to take a look at a less kinder, gentler approach to people who refuse to pay their taxes.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, taxpayers come in all stripes. I mean, we're talking here about the kind of hardcore. A lot of these people are hardcore. We do have about $160 million that we actively collect, work through all the time. In addition to the filing enforcement that we've been talking about, we have about $38 million of that amount. In addition, people are going through bankruptcy or those type of activities. We have another $20 million where the debtor's in the hospital. Those are all part of
about Senator Morrison.
Yeah, and I understand that. I mean, you know, there are reasons why people can't pay their taxes. I think each of those reasons have to be considered.
You bet.
Then when you sift through all of those, there you come to a group who simply will not pay their deadbeats.
Mm-hmm.
And to not have a sanction, I think, is a mistake because that encourages people. They know, you know, you can do all the liens and all that, and they are.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I could not agree with you more. That's why we keep the people out there in the accounts receivable. We keep working them because they do represent a threat. You know, we've talked about it's a voluntary compliance system. People volunteer to file. They volunteer to pay. And in order to keep the system working well, we need people to keep doing that. And the other side of that is if you don't, we need to find you, and we need to work with you to get you to do it. And if you don't want to work with us, we talk about we can do it the easy way or we can do it the hard way. We would prefer the easy way, but we'll take the hard way if that's what's needed to get the filing in and the money in. So we do have tools. We cooperate with the IRS on collection as well. One thing that makes it more difficult is when we have these kind of individuals, they usually, and Representative Smith has touched upon this, they usually owe everybody a lot of money. So, including child support many times too. So it's difficult to get the money, but we sure keep at it. And we work through it and use all the tools we have. We have quite a few tools actually in our grab bag.
Senator Morissette.
Oregon is a great place for deadbeat tax non-compliance people to come. It's a great place. They can come to Oregon and do almost anything they want, and there are very few sanctions that are enforced by the state. That's my read on this.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. This may not be the place. If it's not, please feel free to give me the information. But can you address how payroll tax delinquencies are handled? both on the worker who had the money taken out, and then also with the business owner who has failed to return that money.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, withholding taxes represent a really serious challenge because as companies, small companies, well, all companies, go into financial problems, there's a real temptation to look at the trust funds that you've taken out of your employee's paycheck as withheld to pay their individual taxes and to start using that money and diverting it to cover your own business expenses. That's very, very serious. We watch that very carefully, and we don't, once we see what's happened like for one quarter, we will start working towards that with the company. Usually we work with, we have combined payroll in the state of Oregon where employers can pay their withholding, their workers' compensation assessment, and their UI insurance all in one check and with one form. And we usually work jointly with employment on it because there, a lot of times they're having problems with the unemployment insurance as well. And there are times where we'll actually, it's close the business down because it's not appropriate for them to be running their business on the wages of their employees, that it's come to the point where their business is not sound. Again, you know, we don't want to take that step, but the business needs to realize the severity of the issue and take accountability for it and work through that piece.
Madam Chair, I want to point out there may be another opportunity for us to partner. What was just presented to us is that they do collection on three different areas, and I think there's an opportunity for us to help the entrepreneur and the business owner at the front end by bringing the Employment Department and the Department of Revenue together to help the entrepreneur set up their payroll system correctly from the beginning. And we talked about that in my office, and I'd like to further discuss that because I think one of the biggest issues small business owners have is they truly do not understand how to even set up payroll. And usually they get off on the wrong foot. If they do get off on the wrong foot, it's very difficult to get them back on without having a large financial obligation that they have to clean up.
Thank you, Dallas.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as my former life as a CPA, if your client had serious cash flow problems, the one thing you didn't want them to stop paying was the withholding tax because directors and officers are liable for that personally. As you remember, Senator Warren. So that's the last one you tell employers not to pay. You tell them not to pay the other because, in effect, you're borrowing from the government.
That's right.
That's my rule.
That's thank right. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, too. One of the challenges, and this may get to a question Senator Morris had, a concern he had, is that we have seen a rise, and I think we'll see that in one of our policy option packages. We're asking for additional resources to address it, but into some of these tax sheltering things or promoters who come from state to state and convince a group of people that they don't have to pay taxes, that, you know, you don't have to in the Constitution or whatever. And we've worked really, really vigorously with the IRS to address those people, and several of those people are actually in prison now for fraud, because that is just, it's really horrendous for the system, because people, unfortunately, there's a group of people who like to believe it. We tell you if it's too good to be true, it probably is, you know, and just don't go there.
Thank you. I think in the Senator Morris, and then we're going to move on.
Do we have a performance measurement that addresses the, I guess you might say, the public compliance or confidence in government that they're paying their taxes? I'm having a hard time expressing it, but maybe it's just because since I've gotten into politics from business, I look at the world a little differently, but it seems like that we just have a growing body of the public that has less and less confidence in government, driven by, you know, the talk shows and all this, you know, government is bad, evil, waste, fraud, and abuse, and da 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 da, which to me would then have the potential of rolling over into lack of confidence. So we're going to find ways to not just avoid taxes, but evade taxes, because these are the bad people and they don't need our money.
Against that backdrop, I think that's a perfect segue into the actual performance measures. And if I could ask you to move into that appendix, it is appendix 1. Mm-hmm. and we'll begin with the actual performance measures. And I would like to ask the committee to keep in mind Senator Morris's overarching question as you walk through these performance measures, because I think that that is a very important concept we shouldn't lose track of, both one of keeping the whole mechanism running and one of basic equity for those people that are paying their taxes.
And the performance measures are at the back, but they have their own little tab back here. It's an appendix, and there's a tab back there. Okay.
And again, I'm going to remind the committee that Dallas may interrupt us as we move through these with specific questions and guidance from the co-chairs.
If he can survive today.
If you're trying to make me feel guilty, it's working. Okay, would you please begin?
We'll start. The first one on appendix dash 4 is dollars collected for revenue agents per month, and this is for the personal income tax. You see our target, our actual for 2003 is $68,021. We have revised this, and we've got a request to modify it. The past measure was per FTE. We want to do that per position because we actually hire people. We don't hire FTE. So FTE includes, assumes people don't have vacation time or sick leave or anything like that. So this is really more consistent with what we use as far as our own performance measures, and it works with what we do internally. You can see the real measure for 2006 is that our target would be $77,242. I want to point out this is something you can see with the measures where we're asking for modification. We were asked not to change 0405 because that's what you have approved, the targets for 0405. So we have some sort of strange numbers in here and some kind of strange cross-hatching, and I think Dallas may have noticed this as he went through. But if you look at the future years in the actuals, you should see it. One of the questions...
I'm going to let Dallas interrupt, please.
So then when we get into phase two and start discussing and taking action, because when we come out with the budget report, part of that will be on the performance measures, the subcommittee will be asked to make recommendations on revisions to these targets, so from, which is basically from FTE to position to... Okay.
Yes,
that was the
true
question. It looks a little strange.
Yeah, it does. Madam Chair and Dallas, we actually have behind this, following it, if you want more interested, talk about it later, our request to modify that from appendix dash 16. And that shows a lot. We have several. We're making tweaks. Most of them are changing it from FTE position. And
thank
so it changed the, because the formatting we were asked to follow, it made it look a little odd sometimes. One of the questions that came up as we were visiting with the individual members is how we derive comparator data. We do have within the measure itself, and you can see column 2, summarize how actual performance compares to any relevant public or private industry standards. We actually sent out a listserv on email to all of the states, other states, asking for their performance measures around the same measures we have. We didn't get much of a response, so then we asked the Federation of Tax Administrators to give us a list of the states that they knew that were using performance measures and that could assist us with it. And then we called all of those and worked with those states to try to get comparable data if we could. Sometimes we got pretty close. Other states, other times we didn't. This is one where you could see the range for the states was from $19,000 per employee per month to $104,000. And a lot of that, I think, points out the differences in the state's tax laws and their tax system. So it was pretty hard to find an apple to compare for you in this process, or for us as well.
Okay.
So I will just talk a little bit about this. This is one of the key goals that we talk about. We use these to measure how well our agents are doing individually, and also the success of our technology efforts, because as we put technology in place, we do see this production go up, and we should. Because
does this become part of an individual agent's performance review?
We do.
So that if they're not meeting this standard, there's some kind of action?
Madam Chair, this is an area where we look at as part of an individual's performance. One of the things we're always cautious about is that some of you may recall a few years back the concern the IRS had, or the perception that they were really, you know, handling people very roughly in the tax-paying public. So we want to make sure we don't overemphasize dollars too much per individual so that people go out and have a real drive to do it incorrectly. But we do want them to make sure they meet their standards and exceed it. And actually, we'll talk about this a little bit more when we talk about code of conduct, but the agents that actually get the highest revenue generation are actually those that really do treat people the way they want to be treated. So you can get there by using proper technique.
I don't think any of the committee is suggesting that we want you to send roughshod a bunch of ruffians to go dust up taxpayers who don't comply. But I think what we are looking for is some measures of production.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the measures we do use, Madam Chair, quite extensively throughout the department. And we also use this when we put together all the option packages and also our reduction options. We had the opportunity to share with Dallas and with Linda how we actually measure this, and so they saw that for individual agents and people.
You're asking for quite a number of people in your policy option packages. I'm trying to get a sense of what's the average caseload that this kind of performance would be measured against. If I'm an agent in your department, do I have a caseload of 30, 50, 80, 180?
I may need to get you that information. Their caseloads are quite high right now. Part of it is because of we feel that the accounts receivable is higher than we think it should, and we need additional staff to work that down. So our caseload per agent is much higher than we want it right now. I don't believe I have that number right in here.
But you're asking for full-time people to work down a caseload, and I'm trying to get some sense of how active each one of the agents are, what their targets for revenue received is, how many cases they're managing in a caseload. I'm contrasting it, for example, to DHS workers and the kind of caseloads that they're managing right now.
Madam Chair, the answer partly may be on measure number 6, which is on appendix 9. We do measure, this one again is one we're modifying from for FTE for position. We do measure in addition to the revenue generated. We also ask, measure how many cases they actually close per month. And here you can see that the actual for 2003 was 121 cases per month closed, and that means totally resolved.
121 cases per agent.
Right, per position. That's per position.
Per position, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Ivaki.
I would imagine, too, correct me if I'm wrong, that these numbers are averages, that you may have some people that are collecting specific types or that are further along the delinquency track, so they're harder to collect, or that maybe have the ability to pay more than others do, so it's easier to achieve a $63,000 goal. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Ivaki, that's correct. These are averages, right? And, you know, our more experienced, we have agents who have 20 years' experience, and they traditionally collect very, very high because they have got all the tips and know how to do it. And the other side, we have agents who have then been there for 6 months or a year.
And so that in any given personnel plan, it would reflect that.
Yes. This figure is used as a target or a base, and then the person may be, if the person's traditionally been below that, they need work, and the manager will be working with that person to bring them up to a more appropriate level.
Thank you, Representative. That was very helpful. Senator Morsett.
You mentioned that you checked with other states about performance measures. Have you checked with other states about sanctions for people who do not pay their taxes? Have you?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we do get queries out there. We haven't, I don't know, Elizabeth, have we done any queries recently? Mm-hmm. We do our queries more on specific issues, like what kind of tools, if we're thinking about using a specific tool, like compliance. We've been talking right now about requiring compliance with tax laws before an individual is issued a license, for example, an occupational license. And we've queried the other states about what they're doing in that area. So as we look at individual tools and whether this works for us, we ask and get their, usually because it is a kind of a closed little group, they're very honest with us about whether it works and what the pluses and minuses are.
Follow up, please.
Follow.
I want to do some checking myself. NCSL would be one place, National Council of State Legislators. Is there a better place to check? Could you point me in a direction? Because I do want to find out what other states are doing.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the resource that would be the most targeted toward tax administrators in other states is the Federation of Tax Administrators. tax administrators from all 50 states and the District of Columbia belong to that organization, and they do collect a lot of statistics. I would like to address the theme of your questions, if I may, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead.
In tax compliance, there are two.
I can talk with you about this separately if you want to, or do you?
Well, I just would like to do a couple sentences, okay, just to sort of give you some background information against which maybe your questions can be more focused for us, so that we can get what you want. In tax compliance, there are two kinds of consequences that legislatures typically provide for failure to comply. Criminal consequences are typically reserved for criminal behavior, which involves criminal intent to and fraud to evade taxation. Oregon does have statutes on the books that set forth criminal penalties that are consequences for evasion. But the standard of proof for we have to show that a taxpayer has committed a tax crime. It has to be prosecuted by the DA, and then if they go to jail, they're probably not going to pay us. The other kind of consequence, which is very common among all the states, is on the civil side, is interest and penalties for failure to do what people who are initiating their own compliance do every year. And in Oregon, in the filing enforcement arena, where if people have not filed a return for three consecutive years, the penalty is 100% of the tax. So that's been true for...
Plus interest.
That's been true since the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Other states have similar structure. The criminal consequences are reserved for those who are, with criminal intent, evading taxation. And proving that is something that takes a lot of resource and usually costs more than the amount of tax that taxpayer owes. So we are always having to balance, given the resource that we've got, what's going to be the most effective way to assure the long-term health of the system by getting people in and doing what they're supposed to be doing, as opposed to criminal consequences. We've had situations in the past where we did go to court and actually with people who were taking the position that they didn't have to file because they had some interesting view of the Constitution, and even the court was frustrated by the attitude and the resistance of some individuals, and there were people who were put in jail and just sat there and said, "I still don't have to comply, and I'm not gonna." So what we are trying to do is make sure that we get to those dollars that are going to come in. One thing Susan hasn't mentioned yet, because we've got it more in our overview of the income tax programs, is one of the tools that we use that's very popular with taxpayers, and it does get them in the system and paying, is pay plans. And so in that, accounts receivable are going to be accounts where people have agreed to a payment plan,
mm-hmm.
And they're making their payments, but we're still showing the amount that's outstanding, although we're not working very hard to collect those dollars because we've already got an agreement and they're sending in a payment every month. So we'll try and break that out of that larger number. But we certainly can check with other states on mm-hmm. on what kinds of criminal sanctions and for what sorts of issues.
Thank you. Just before Senator Morris's question, for the benefit of anybody who might be watching this hearing, Representative Krupp is excused. Representative Smith will be right back. Senator Morissette has a conflict and had to leave at 9:45 and inform the chair. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we get into phase two, I would appreciate an opportunity to understand your management techniques and the things that you do to flag. When do you flag? How do you respond when someone has not filed or the payments haven't come in on withholdings, so that we can understand that a little bit better?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we'd be happy to do that and talk a little bit more about that process. Are we ready to move on to number two, which is percent of property taxes collected?
Yes, please.
Okay. This one's not changed. We have not been able to find any comparable data available for that, but figure has been moving upward. Our target is 93.8%. We're currently at 93.7%. So this is one that is going pretty well. This, again, demonstrates our partnership with the counties. What can we do in this area?
I actually would like some amplification, because the question that's presented is, what needs to be done as a result of your analysis? And the answer is, continue partnerships with county collection offices. And I'm not quite sure that I understand what that means. Could you nuance that or dig a little deeper and tell me exactly what the action plan is with that?
Madam Chair, the property tax collection is accomplished at the local level. I think the only tax dollars that the Revenue Department handles in the property tax system are small railroads, where we go ahead and collect the money so they don't have to write a lot of little checks around the state. But everything else is collected at the local level. And the role that we play is in training for county staff, in what the constraints are under the statutes under which they operate, and then supporting materials, you know, techniques and that sort of thing. But one of the things about the property tax system is the tax itself is automatically a lien on the property, and there's an advanced collection system for property taxes that's sort of similar to the withholding system in the income tax, and that is, if you've got a mortgage, your mortgage holder has a financial interest in making sure that there's no property tax lien outstanding on that property, and the escrow account portion of your mortgage payment, you know, if your mortgage is 80% or more, typically, is going to have an element for property taxes in it. So every month you're making a payment of your property tax to your mortgage holder, and your mortgage holder then is making sure that those taxes are paid to protect their financial interest in the property. So there's just a natural interest on the part of the financing side to see to it that those taxes are paid, and that probably contributes a lot to the high level of compliance. For properties where there is no mortgage, the property is owned free and clear, or enough equity exists in the property that the mortgage holder doesn't insist on an escrow payment, the property owner does get a bill and is responsible. If they do not pay for 3 years, then the county forecloses on the property, and it's sold at sheriff's sale for the taxes, and so the taxes are collected in that way. And so there's only about a 3-year grace period before property will be sold to satisfy a property tax obligation.
Again, I guess where I'm headed is training of county collection staffs, development and maintenance of support materials and manuals. Does that become a fee for service? Does that become how many counties take advantage of your active training? When you say continue the partnership, I'm trying to see how well is the partnership doing? By what measure do I determine that this partnership is successful?
Madam Chair, we can certainly get you statistics on our training offerings and participation by the counties.
That would be very helpful.
We'll do it.
Good. Measure 3%, of assessor's maps digitized. This is one of the measures that's really had quite a change. And basically, we're going to be talking about this a little bit more when we talk about the Oregon Map Project and our efforts to, by our goal really is by 2008 to get 100% of the assessor's maps digitized. But this shows us doing it by the year 2010.
I'd like to understand something that I didn't. I had to leave the tour yesterday, unfortunately, to go be on a legislative panel, and this is the question I would have asked had I been there. I think many people's first contact with local government is standing across a counter down in land services or whatever you each county calls it, trying to figure out how to make something work, and frequently being disappointed. And I think that my question about how these digitizing all these assessor's maps, would it be conceivable that I could stand at the counter in Columbia County and ask a question about a map in Sherman County and actually be able eventually to have that map come up on a computer terminal and be able to have copies, manipulate it, use it, understand it?
Madam Chair, that's the goal of the Oregon Mapping Project, is that we would have a statewide digitized map base, seamless, across all 36 counties, available on the Internet.
Okay. That seems like a very straightforward goal, and I'm just trying to figure out, from being able to look at this, how is it going? And it seems like 2010 is an awfully long ways out for something that seems as cut and dry as this. That's 5 years from now. What are the impediments to being able to deliver this service to Oregonians faster?
Madam Chair, there are two challenges that we face. One is resources and priorities within the counties. The most significant of the two.
Meaning each county would have to subscribe to this service individually. So Sherman County, and I'm not picking on Sherman County, but Sherman County could just decide this isn't important and therefore not ever allocate or appropriate funds to do it and never be part of the system?
Madam Chair, that is correct in part. We've got 14 counties where the state, where our department maintains maps for the counties. And so any county where we maintain the maps, we're going ahead and doing the work to bring them into that digital form.
And how did those 14 end up housed with you?
Typically, they don't have enough financial resources to afford to have a cartographer, a person who's an expert in mapping, on their own staff. And Sherman County is a great example because they have 1.5 FTE, and one of those FTE is the elected assessor. So they simply cannot afford to pay and maintain a staff person who does the mapping work, so they contract with us to do that work for them. It's much more economical. The mapping project is one that involves a substantial number of partnerships among local governments and between levels of government, local, state, federal, and then also with the private sector, because having a readily accessible, very accurate map base is something that has private value as well as public value. So, as I said, two barriers. One is cost and the competing priorities for limited dollars at the local level. Two is there's still a lot of concern about the accessibility of information that some counties have used as a revenue source. And since the data itself is collected at the local level, the data about the property description, the ownership, the value, how it's improved, what the zoning is, how it's being used, is collected at the local level. Some counties have put that information together, packaged it in CDs, and sold it into the title industry, escrow companies, real estate companies, for a monthly subscription. And it's a revenue source for those counties. So they're reluctant to let go of that. There are some pretty significant public records issues. You know, whose data is it anyway? And so some of the counties are very, very protective of that data, that it belongs to, you know, them as opposed to belongs to the greater public. And so we're having to work through some of those issues. There's a statewide group called the Oregon Geographic Information Council that is coordinated through the Department of Administrative Services that's trying to work through some of these issues. And it's my belief that we're going to have to come back to the legislature and get some of those ownership of data and public access to data questions resolved here, because the public records law was written at a time when documents were paper. Now it's digital, it's available on the Internet, and you get the whole range of anxiety about my private information. People can get it, they can play with it any way they want to, and it's much more powerful because it's a component of information that's available to anybody around the world once it's posted on the Internet. So we've got some issues there that we're going to have to work our way through that are going to take some time. The funding stream, we do have the dollar per recorded document that that was dedicated by the legislature starting in 1999 to use as grants to help fund some of this work, and we are using that. We're trying to get the counties all have business plans for their mapping project to get to goal four by, actually it is by 2008. Everybody is at goal two now. We've accomplished our first two goals, and now we're moving toward goal four. But the cooperation that's necessary between surveyors, mapping folks in the counties who may be in they may be in the assessor's office, but they might be in the planning office. It is requiring a major culture change at the local level. We've encouraged counties to come together in regional groups and do planning regionally to deal with some of the edge mapping issues where things aren't quite consistent, so that we can have that seamless database. But we've got cultural change going on, and this project is one of the ways that that's happening.
Representative Abaki.
Two questions. First, I don't exactly understand the significance of the maps to your mission. And then second, do you have the authority to require them to participate in this, or is it voluntary on each county's basis?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, our role is twofold. One, we establish the standards. By statute, we establish the standards for the quality and character and appearance and accuracy of the maps that are maintained at the local level. The property tax map are the maps are the base for the system operating appropriately, because you pay your property tax based on what you own. So there has to be an accurate record somewhere, usually it's at the county level, of what property you own, what its value is, how it's been improved, how it's being used, and so forth. Our role is, so standard setting is one role. The other, as I mentioned, there are 14 counties where their resources are better spent by contracting with the state to maintain their maps so that they have that that accurate map base. If the department withdrew from doing mapping, what would probably happen is the counties that had adequate resources would be able to continue to keep their maps up to date with current ownership changes and divisions of property and changes in use and zoning and everything else. But the counties that have smaller resource bases would fall behind, and the accuracy of their maps and therefore the accuracy of the billing system would be potentially at risk.
I think I heard you to say that through an administrative rule process, you do have the authority to require them to do it if you want to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't answer your second question. Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, with respect to the Oregon Mapping Project, that is voluntary on the part of the counties. We use the carrot approach. We have grant dollars. We encourage you to participate. All of the counties have signed up for participation in regions around the state. Their ability to participate really, really actively and to move quickly is affected by their own financial and political picture within the county. But we do not have the authority to compel them to participate in the Oregon Mapping Project. That was just not the fundamental basis of the theory behind the project to begin with. Our rulemaking authority is limited to the standards that their maps that they keep within the county must meet, but not to require them to participate in this digitization effort.
Ellis.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the questions that was posed yesterday by the co-chairs was, why isn't it 100%? And they were liking this to having a GPS system in the car. It'll tell them where they're at anywhere in the state. So isn't this already done? And they were equating a locator using a GPS system that there must be a map somewhere already computerized so that the GPS system could tell you where you're at. So I couldn't tell them all. There are different things involved, and I don't think GPS systems have the improvements on the land or.
I don't think we're talking about road maps, though.
No, we're not.
But that's
property description.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the point that Dallas has raised is a great question. GPS systems don't have to be as accurate as tax maps have to be. And the surveyors will tell you that that there's a and part of our standard is that there's an accuracy requirement depending upon the nature of the area that's been mapped. So within a city, we've got to be accurate within a foot. In urban areas, we our accuracy standard is 10 feet, and out in what they affectionately call the pucker brush, it's about 20 yards. Because it's not crucial to have that precision of lines when you're talking about big tracts of property where the use is real consistent and the values are fairly low. Whereas in a city where you're talking about subdivisions, you really do have to be very accurate about square footage of property. And a global positioning system can tell you where you are with some level of accuracy. But it is more based on highway maps and not the precision of exactly how many square feet is your lot.
I guess I'm making this comment both to you as the director of a state agency and to the counties who I know are represented here in the hearing room today, and that is that this area seems to be one that engages citizens frequently not well. And it seems to me that if we are talking about a public service and what is the policy of the state of Oregon with respect to our customers, whether they're local government customers or state customers, saying that a cultural change is difficult to affect just isn't a satisfactory answer to me. And I think that this is a state problem and a local government problem. And this would be one of the demonstrable ways that government with a capital G could collectively provide a much desirable service to our citizens. And your performance measures on this issue don't look very good. I don't know what happened in 2004. It seems to be an estimated number, but the drop from 62% to 32%. Is not very attractive against a 70% goal, or am I reading this incorrectly?
Madam Chair, no. Performance measure number 3 has been totally revamped, basically. I think that probably we need to do more work on performance measure 3. There is a nice chart on page Elizabeth was talking about.
If it's been totally revamped, why is it in the book?
Well, there are some challenges we've had with the performance measure system and how much we can actually modify on the measures.
Yeah.
We would like to scrap this one and start over.
That was a requirement that came out of the last legislative session. For the record, Kelly Freels, F-R-E-E-L-S, with Budget and Management. But I was actually on the group that went through when agencies wanted to make modifications, and one of the parameters was we had to go back to what the legislature approved last legislative session. And if there were any changes made, they had to come back to the subcommittees and get those changes made, which are part of the phase two. I think the problem with this is when we have changes that are realistic, by providing you the old information that doesn't give you good information and not providing the information we think is most accurate is a disservice to the process, and we'll probably make changes next time, or we will make changes next
Thank
time.
Thank you for that historical perspective, but I think we all have to be vigilant, too, that we're not scrapping measures that show bad results because they don't report accurately.
And that was one of the rationale behind no changes.
Yeah.
What you have shared with us just in the verbal description, leaving this written narrative and depiction aside, is something that isn't apparently working very well. And we're paying lip service to partnerships with the counties, but I don't hear evidence of a lot of forward movement being made, with the exception of the 14 counties that are buying your services directly.
Madam Chair, what seems interesting, would be interesting to me along the lines of what you're talking about, is what the county's perspective in all of this, too, because it seems like a lot of your data is really based on something that is somewhat out of your control. Especially, it seems to me, with these maps, the game changes every year as buildings or properties are raised and others are built or modified, that the maps would need to be updated continuously. And you're dependent almost completely on the counties to do that. And your scores would reflect whether they're doing it or not.
I'm curious that's what the counties would be saying if they were at the table.
That's very well stated, and again, in keeping with the co-chair's request that we stay with a high-level agency overview, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask Dallas to flag this as something that we come back to early in Phase 2, with the counties having the opportunity to present, and then maybe we could get a dialogue between the counties and the agency and figure out how perhaps the legislature could give some guidance or some support to getting a more streamlined process with better outcomes.
Look forward to that.
And since we have the counties somewhat in the room when they do that, I'd be interested to know what they see as the carrot, or even if they see a carrot somewhere ahead of them that they're interested in having.
I see the counties very actively taking notes, so I think we will rely on them to share that information with us. All right, let's move to number four.
Okay, Madam Chair. This is a taxpayer assistance contract. This one's been modified, too. We totally revamped this one. The old targets you can see for 2004-2005 that we maintained, this really did it on a per FTE basis. And what we're measuring now is simply is the overall total of website hits and calls that we get to the tax services unit for assistance. The comparator data you can see, we didn't try to factor this in for population, but Iowa had 386,000, Missouri reported 599, and Arizona report 891,000. This is one where we are trying real hard. We're using this one a lot to try to move people from the tax services calls. This is through the interactive voice response. So this is when you call and get information and you can use it yourself. We're trying to use this technology very much to have taxpayers be able to get access to the information. We have just came up yesterday an application called Where's My Refund? Where taxpayers can use the web to go in and look up the status of their own refund check. Every season we have a huge phone calls that come in to our phone receptionist people, phone answering people, to try to look up people's refunds for them. Some people call multiple times, like every week, until they get the refund check. So this will allow the web site that we've just brought up will allow people to serve their own needs. So this is one where we really work very hard on trying to maximize use of technology, provide information at a really low cost. Okay. Ready to move to number five. This one's been revised again from per FTE to per position, and then actually brings the numbers down, but you can kind of see their targets are. This is personal income tax non-filer assessments issued per employee per month. We've talked quite a bit about the filing enforcement program. This is where we issue the assessments for the people who are not filing. And this piece, we want the agents to work not only towards a number as a standard, but quality. They need to make sure they have really good assessments out there so that as we work to collect it, it represents as much as we possibly can an accurate assessment of the tax owed. Okay. And let's see.
Senator Morse.
Why is the target declining so much?
This one, I would have to get back to you on that, Senator Morris. That one's a... okay. All right, I remember. There's what's an example of a department activity related to this measure? I was trying to refresh my memory on this. We had put additional resources into filing enforcement on this work, and we have shifted some of the resources back to the people back to doing other work with... on accounts receivable for income taxpayers who are coming in that are filers. We're finding right now, and I think we mentioned with you, that we're seeing a growth in the number of people who are filing but are unable to pay. So we've been working with those individuals to put them on payment plans and to get them set up and get them paying. So we're shifting some of our resources from the work on the filing enforcement back to that. We did really concentrate our efforts back in 2003 and had a real big hit trying to work towards filing enforcement and cleaning up some of it and doing some of that work. And you see a big rise in 2003. We're moving back down towards a more normal number on that piece. So we're shifting our resources. This is an example of a measure where we really are using it. We're going, how do we balance our resources? Do we want to have working with filing taxpayers or non-filing taxpayers? We shifted our resources to move towards more non-filing in that 1 year, and then we're shifting back.
Follow-up.
for future consideration as we get into this in more depth. I think it'd be very important for us to understand the consequences of you managing your resources this way, mm-hmm. as opposed to supplying greater resources. What are we giving up by not managing the number of filers and redirecting the filers that can't pay? What are we giving up?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, some of this discussion was a real impetus for our policy option package, asking for additional resources for the gross and accounts receivable, because we realize that we're shifting our staff back and forth trying to meet both of these needs, and we're not doing an adequate job in meeting the needs of those people who are trying to file and pay versus those who aren't filing. So you're right. We need to really look at this, and this one raised to that level that we need to have some more resources. We're understaffed in this area.
I think a sub-question that would follow with that is, if you are able to shift resources, can you clean up a portfolio in one place by having concentrated resources applied to it, and then once that portfolio is manageable, move those people again rather than adding additional people?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do that. We actually had what we called a collection speed-up, I think it was last... Not just by any means, by 103. Oh, 103, when the legislature asked us to generate more revenue with our existing staff. And what we said was, what we could do is we could shift our resources to try to collect the more easily collectible accounts. And we did. We shifted it over and we brought in more revenue. And then we shifted back over to the filing enforcement. So we're always trying to figure out how to allocate our resources to maximize the revenue, but also make sure that the compliance stays high. And we are dealing with the non-filers as well. So it's a shift. But right now we feel we're understaffed to really do an adequate job with the accounts receivable piece.
Okay, I think this is one we're going to want to tag and come back to.
I was going
to
say, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think one of the questions that we'll need to deal with in the policy option packages is, with respect to the resources, is how much is enough and how much more is needed. Both of those questions, because there's some incremental staffing and there's revenue associated with it. Well, if the population out there, or if the demand out there indicates more resources would yield additional revenues, might that be possible and achievable in the next biennium? So.
And Madam Chair, this is one of these areas too where we do look for technology. I'm trying to do a lot more of automation to make it easier for our administrative specialists to do these assessments and to get access to the data. So there's some real improvements that we've worked on too.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to the
number six. This one we talked about a little bit already, the cases closed per revenue agent. You're talking about what are employees evaluated on. They're evaluated on their revenue production, they're evaluated on cases closed, and if they're working with non-filer assessments, they're evaluated on that as well. This one, again, changed from per FTE to per position. You can see that. The numbers for actual numbers for 2003 were 121. Our target for 2006 is 158. Questions on that one? Number seven. We talked about this a little bit as well. This is when our filing enforcement agents actually contact the taxpayer and work with them. We really urge them to try to get the taxpayer, if possible, to file their returns. And you can see we've actually revised this one upward. You can see that the old targets are in here too. This has gone to per FTE and per position again, but we also revised the target up on this one. So you can see the actual for 2003 per position is 19, and we want our target up to 29. So we have a pretty aggressive goal on this one. We did the closest. I'm sorry.
You think you're going to achieve this aggressive goal by what factors?
By using some of the technology. We've got some new tools we hope that will be useful on that, and to do. We think we're doing pretty well. A lot of this is training and of our staff on how to work with taxpayers and how to use the information correctly, and also how options we can provide. We talked about payment plans. That's attractive to some of the people, that if they can come into with their return. If they come forward, Lisbeth's mentioned
3 years of not filing gets you 100% penalty. If you come forward voluntarily, we can waive part of that penalty. If you come forward without any contact from us, we waive even more of it. So there is a carrot out there as well as the hammer. The hammer's the 100% penalty.
And maybe, actually, it's your discretion, of course, maybe we don't want to get into this now, but it sounds to me like you're describing, in essence, an amnesty plan that you have control over based on per individual, and wonder if you want to make any comments about some amnesty plans that are being bandied about the building now that would be more of a blanket type of amnesty on what it sounds like exactly what you're talking about.
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, that's a good way of characterizing it. I think the legislature has given us a variety of tools to use, including the 100% penalty, but then the ability to waive it if the taxpayer comes forward voluntarily and cooperates with us. So we offer that to taxpayers and as an incentive to try to get them to come forward. And we talk with our agents a lot about options to provide and how to do that piece. And I know Senate Revenue is talking about some of the more traditional amnesty programs as well. And we'll certainly be happy to talk with you about that if you're interested. Okay?
I'm sorry to ask what may be a very elementary question, but if you could go back to number six. This is the personal and corporate tax cases closed per, now we're going to go to position when the thing is rewritten, versus the delinquent returns filed after the compliance contact. Are these... So each agent or position is closing 121 cases a month, and of that, 19 of them are, or 22 for this year, 22 of them are delinquent.
Madam Chair, on number six, all of those would be the delinquent. The person hasn't paid their taxes. So we're closing, on an average, 121 collection cases per month per person. So the person hasn't paid their account. So we've resolved it. We've worked with them in writing or on the phone, or we visit them in the field. And this is for across the whole personal income tax incorporation program. So you talked about an individual agent. He or she every month has their work queue that they're working. And of those taxpayers assigned to them for collection, on average, they're resolving 121 of those each month satisfactorily. We're getting it paid. We're working on a settlement plan. We're getting something done on it, paid off, closed. On number seven, what we're talking about there is this just a piece of it. That could be part of the 121. It could be we don't have it resolved yet, but the person has filed a return. We've got them to come forward. And this is a smaller group of this piece. The filing enforcement is a working with the non-filers. This is for all of our taxpayers, filers and non-filers.
And
does that make sense?
If I may, Madam Chair, the base of employees isn't, seven isn't totally included inside six. Measure number six is revenue agents. Those are collectors. Measure number seven is filing enforcement employees, which is a different group of people. It includes administrative specialists and revenue agents, and I think even a few auditors work in our filing enforcement program.
For self-employed.
And so what we're trying to measure here is that for the effort we're putting in specifically into filing enforcement, which is getting people to file returns, these are the returns that are coming in response to that effort. Measure number six is of all of the collection cases we've got in our revenue agents' queues, how many are they satisfactorily resolving? And most of them are very likely to be there's already a return, and it was somebody didn't pay everything they reported was due. So the base is very different. We have a lot more revenue agents just doing collection work than we do filing enforcement employees.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Good.
Del, do you have anything to add?
Okay, let's see. Number eight, assessor satisfaction with DOR service level. We do a survey in every other year of our county assessors and ask them how we're doing in providing services to the counties. And
It basically asks for their level of satisfaction. I know there's a requirement now to have a performance measure with customer service, and this is our initial step at that. We're also working on another measure that will deal more with the personal income tax program.
That's going to be the next question. How many taxpayers are happy with the department sort of symbol?
Okay. Madam Chair, Dallas, it's probably not going to be how many are happy with the department, but how many feel they were treated respectfully and understood how they were treated, that kind of
thing.
So I'm not sure they're ever going to be necessarily happy with the department. Might be too high a standard for us to meet. Number nine is average days to issue personal income tax refund. We just talked already about where's my refund application. This is very, very important to taxpayers, and this is one that the processing center staff look at very closely. And it's really a partnership with our policy and systems area, too, on how to set up the tax season each year so it runs as efficiently as possible. And this one hasn't been changed. You can see our comparator data. Again, these are Iowa has 10 days, Missouri 13, Arizona 13, ours is 16. These are different kind of tax systems, but that was about as close as we could get to give you some comparisons. Okay. Number 10, percent filed electronically of the personal income tax returns. This is a one that we have a great deal of interest in as well. This one I think we changed too. Let's change this one. No. That our target is really low on this one, and actually we revised our target up to 51% again, and that one may be low based on what we're seeing for 2003. Electronic filing is a very efficient way for taxpayers to file for the department and also for themselves as well. Comparator data there, you can see Iowa 62, Arizona 41, Arizona's goes up to 58% when they include 2D barcode, and I think you had a chance, some of you, to see the 2D barcoding system. And our rate's 35% when we include 2D barcode, it goes up to 51%. So you can see the breakout in on the little chart of the e-file returns, which are the black, and the 2D barcodes are the dark gray. And actually on this one, I think our target, based on our recent experience, probably needs to be higher than what we're showing there.
In the main, are you finding most of the programs to be acceptable to your standards?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, most of the programs, the software programs are. We have in our policy and systems unit, we actually test them to make sure that the output is acceptable for Oregon before we kind of bless them for use in Oregon. So, but on the whole, most of them seem to be working really well. There's quite a good group in the industry that's working on electronic filing, trying to make it better. And we are looking at possibly a free filing option somewhere down the road, maybe next season for us. So, for the department.
I didn't hear you.
A free filing. So taxpayers can file electronically free in the state of Oregon. So we're looking at that as well.
In other words, Madam Chair, right now they have to pay a fee in order to be able to file electronically.
I know that the only reason that I appeared to be recoiling from that is that I just think that as agencies, not just your agency, but as all agencies, move more and more into a technology realm and encourage interactions via technology, that we don't set up two kinds of Oregonians, those who get some benefit by virtue of their ability to interact with the state electronically, and those who somehow the perception is they're penalized. I'm thinking of a lot of elderly people, a lot of lower income people, folks who just may not traditionally have the access or ability to use computers. And I am just cognizant of the fact that we would have two classes of folks. And to the degree that I want to encourage technology, I think that's terrific. I just want to be cognizant of the fact that we don't want to build penalties into those who are not electronic filers.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we've talked about electronic filing, always maintaining it as voluntary. So we would never discuss going to a mandatory system like that. And we realize there will always be a need for paper, because there are some people who feel more comfortable with paper, and that's the way they need to go.
Good. Thanks.
Could I just add something, Madam Chair? One of the benefits of of maximizing the numbers of people who file electronically is that we can probably give better attention to the remaining paper returns.
I agree with you.
It helps us with our overall efficiency and effectiveness.
And make no mistake, I'm advocating electronic filing. I just want to make sure that in rule promulgation or in any other agency deliberations that we're just conscious of the fact that there may be a group of people unable to do so, and I don't want to put them at an institutionalized disadvantage.
Sure. We're delighted when people file in whatever format that is.
Sure.
Number 11 is employee work environment. Department of Revenue is primarily personal services. We are people, and so we've got a measure in here to evaluate the work environment. It's actually on a scale. We 1 to 6. 1 is very dissatisfied, and 6 is very satisfied. So you can see our score for 2004 is 4.48. And we're shooting for 5.25 out as we go forward. Okay. I gave you some comparator data. Again, this is one that it's hard to know. Arizona has a similar measure. When we looked at it, their rating is 4.42. And then Wisconsin said that 64% of their employees are satisfied. So we thought we're pretty much in the ballpark here.
Against what do you judge this, though? I'd be kind of curious to see what your survey looks like. And what I'm trying to distinguish is there are not on-the-job injuries. The workspace is conducive to doing high-production work. I was really surprised touring your physical plant yesterday to come away with the impression how much of the equipment seems to have been sort of modified in situ, that somebody figures out we can't stack papers this high, so we better build a little slot to hold them in. And it seems as though there's been a fair amount of imagination used to deal with problems. I'm also told that as a result of the tour, one of your employees came up with some kind of a plan that is unique to the department and saved a great deal of money just through their knowledge of computers. And I just am curious how you do this workplace environment. What are some of the elements that factor into your employees deciding that it's a attractive environment versus not?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we'd be happy to share a copy of the survey with Dallas for you. The things that we evaluate or ask employees for are things like training, developmental opportunities, job rotation. We spend a lot of time and energy in trying to train our employees on the jobs they have and also working with them to promote upward in the jobs within the department. And we've had people who've started as clerical and who are now like senior tax auditors. So we really need to build upon their skills and give them some opportunities to really get some training and go forward. The one score we did get, we've had some struggles with, is our space and our furniture, and we're working on that as well. I don't think you saw the really crowded areas, but some of our areas are pretty crowded, and we're working on that piece. So that's something we asked too, is the physical and work environment. Is that okay for you?
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the thing that came up yesterday afternoon were numbers 11 and 12 with the employee work environment and training. If you can measure or correlate them to production or collection, so that's actually getting very mercenary to tie it to collections or something, you know, job efficiency sort of thing. That would be nice to see if there's some way to correlate. So you can measure the effectiveness or the benefits, if you will, of the investment in the environment and the training. I think some of it is almost intuitive with some training and update on current tax law and collection or other practices, but others maybe less.
They can follow the curriculum. The kind of
right
would be helpful for me to understand what that looks like.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you really see that number 12, which is our employee training per year. We spend quite a bit of time. Our benchmark on this is we want to have our employees receive at least 20 hours of skill training in the past year. And as we bring, like, for instance, new auditors in, they actually have a classroom that they're in for like 3 months, I believe it is, and then they actually go out and sit with another auditor for another 3 months. So we bring in people who have really good background, but maybe coming from another another industry, another agency, or right out of school. And we put them through 3 months of sit down, and here's the tax law books, and you actually have people come in and train you on all of that, and there's tests, and it's just like school. And then they graduate and have a little ceremony, and then they go out and work with other tax auditors. We do something very similar with the revenue agents. As they come in, we talk to them about the collection techniques we want them to use, how the systems work, expectations of performance, that type of things. And then we have kind of refreshers, too, for that. So it's over the years, we've gotten to be a much more formalized kind of training process for the big groups of employees. But then we also want to make sure we have opportunities for people who have that kind of creative spark and kind of want to use their skills and become IT professionals or something else. And we can learn a lot from their knowledge of the systems as they promote up in our agency and our values.
It was pretty clear there was a creative spark over there yesterday, just seeing how individual employees had modified their work areas to be able to handle just the physical presence of paper and checks and stuff. And it appears you get a lot of good suggestions from the folks that are actually doing the day-to-day work.
Madam Chair, after each season, the folks in the center do a debrief and ask themselves what went really well, what helped us with productivity, what do we need to work on improving, where were the bottlenecks, how do we open up bottlenecks. And there's a culture in that center of constant improvement and feedback on how well are we doing. And new targets are set every season for production, of moving money through, moving returns through, moving payments through.
Good. Well, on that very optimistic, good note, I think we will, unless there is objection, close the public hearing on House Bill 5066, and the committee will stand adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30. Without objection, we're adjourned.
Thank you.